Thundergrunt.
To the first episode of Writer's Blockbusters. I'm your host, Bob Rose, and we're going to pretend like this is kindergarten, and we're going to go around the table, and we're going to introduce ourselves. Is everybody good with that?
My name's Jimmy George, and I read scripts for a living.
No, that's what you do. Well, say something about yourself.
That's one thing, Jimmy.
Yeah.
I have a big, scraggly beard.
Next, Jamie.
I'm Jamie Nash. I write screenplays for a living, and I can juggle five balls.
Really? Only five?
Yeah, this
you
is
can really juggle five balls?
Yes, I can juggle five balls. I'm doing it right now. Oh. See? Look, here's seven.
That's amazing!
Yeah, I thought it was eight.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a talent for radio.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm Bob Rose. I'm not going to say I write scripts for a living, even though I do write scripts, but not for a living. And I'm going to say that on this podcast, I'm the audience surrogate.
Sure.
Yeah. Cause you guys are the pros. I'm here to make sure this, there's noise.
Whenever I hear surrogate, I think of sex. So
really, I think of that Bruce Willis movie.
The Surrogate.
Me too. Exactly.
With Buzz from Home Alone in it. Sorry. So today in this first episode, we're going to tackle something that's just a light subject. There's nothing heavy about it at all. Like, absolutely not for three white guys to talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to talk about the script to Get Out. Just some light material.
A feel good movie.
We were teetering on talking about Captain Ron, but we decided this instead. You know, it was Captain Ron or Get Out. So
next week we'll talk about the Me Too movement and feminism.
Right.
Yeah.
As opposed to Bridesmaids. We'll kind of work it in there.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, we're going to talk about Get Out today because, I mean, it's up for an Oscar.
Yeah.
Several Oscars.
Many Oscars. Many. Yeah.
Many. Yeah. Best Picture, yeah. Best Director,
Best Actor.
Oh, is it? I didn't look at all the. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Best screenplay.
Okay, so yeah. I mean, it kind of lit the world on fire. It's for Hollywood a low budget movie.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
It made like $400 million, yeah, something like that, worldwide.
What was it? $4.5 million budget.
Was it only $4.5 million?
It was below ten.
I was going to say below that, but I'm not positive about that.
Yeah, I know it was below ten.
It's a moneymaker, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Blumhouse model, it was a Blumhouse film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Blumhouse model, I mean, all their movies are under $5 million. And I think
is that a rule?
Pretty much by rule. I mean, once they do, like, The Purge or some sequel like that, like The Purge 2, they might go up to $10
million
or
where
something.
Where it has a name to it.
Where it has
of.
A name.
Yeah.
Maybe The Conjuring 2, even though, is that... That's I can't remember.
Yeah, I wonder how much Halloween is being made for.
Yeah, that's another one.
I mean, The Conjuring is a cinematic universe at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so those movies might get a little more, I think. I don't have any official numbers. I don't have their spreadsheets in front of me or anything. But
how dare you not
Jesus,
have those spreadsheets?
Jamie?
But I honestly think like Get Out feels like one of those 2.5 million movies that they make. I'm not even sure that 4 million actually sounds high for them. And I remember hearing stories about how they moved their location at the last minute. I think they were going to shoot it somewhere and they moved it to Alabama
for
tax
budget.
Breaks. And it was like a last minute decision and they had to rewrite the script.
Yeah.
So I think it's super cheap.
I remember somewhere around 2 to 4. So that seems about right.
Yeah.
But it made massive Hollywood blockbuster money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do you think that is? Why do you guys think that is?
Well, for one thing, it rings true. You know, like, I feel like a lot of people are watching that and going, like, this is my life. You know, I mean,
no,
without the craziness
it's
aside.
It's almost another podcast completely.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It's so timely, it's almost unreal.
Yeah. And also, it's very eye-opening for people who have never experienced that, you know. And, you know, so that's another conversation piece. You got to see this and see what I just realized, you know.
Right. Yeah. This is going to be spoiler-filled, by the way, for anyone listening.
Yeah.
We're not going to hold back on that. Right.
Yep. And I think a big part of it is Jordan Peele writing it. He brought in like a new audience to the horror market.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing We're all kind of people that watch horror movies. Maybe Jimmy and I a little more than Bob.
I'm not.
Watch them all.
I love horror comedies. Yeah. So this is it. Actually, I saw Get Out 4 or 5 times because to me it is a horror and a comedy.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
I love the mixture. When it comes to straight horror, I don't watch that much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't hate it.
It's
not my deal.
But I think horror films are less effective in some ways on horror fans that go see them.
Yeah.
So I think that this movie opened it up to a wider audience. Like audiences that don't go see horror movies are usually scared of it. They'll go see Get Out and they'll laugh. They'll be filled with tension. They'll crack up, all those things. So it had all those ranges of emotion.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of why
it was very accessible.
It's one of those things where sometimes the best movies are unclassifiable in genre. Like, I used to manage a video store. I don't know where exactly I'd put Get Out. The thriller section actually seems like the most
supernatural thriller. Yeah. It almost seems like supernatural thriller.
But it teeters right under it. Like, is the Coagula supernatural? Yeah. I don't know, really. Yeah.
Feels like it, though. It feels like there's some kind of weird haunting or something.
Yeah,
it feels like
there's this supernatural thing in the background that you never see.
It's,
definitely.
I guess, sci-fi in some ways, but...
Well, it's definitely sci-fi.
Yeah, there's some sci-fi in there. So you're right. It's a big mix.
It's because I always think of stuff like video stores, which are a dead thing. But where would you put this VHS? Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe thriller. Maybe
thriller
horror,
just seems it kind of encapsulates everything that this is.
But the title,
it's not very bloody or anything.
It seems like with the title and the trailer, they were leaning horror. I mean, Get Out.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely sold it as a horror movie
for sure. It's like surreal. There's notes of Suspiria and stuff in there with like the dreams. And you know what I'm saying? It's like it's unclassifiable in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of an amazing mixture of everything.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. $175 million plus change domestic. And its foreign was 79 million.
Wow, so it did better here.
It did much better
here.
And it feels like a very American film.
It does feel,
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is odd. Do you guys, not script-based, but do you guys remember when Sam Jackson was asked about this movie?
No, I didn't hear it.
The one thing he said, which was really odd, was he was like, the only thing he didn't like was that the main character wasn't played by an American actor.
Wow.
Which, just according to those numbers, is kind of like this weird... that made me think of that. It was a very odd thing for him to say. Like, he wasn't, like, excited about the movies. Just like, I think the main guy should have been American because it's an American problem.
Coming from him.
Coming from Sam
that's
Jackson,
really
it was just
surprising.
Like, whoa, okay, I never thought of that.
Yeah. Sam Jackson, they're taking our jobs. It doesn't seem like...
Yeah, he almost seemed like I should have been the guy.
But he himself, Daniel, in interviews, he said, he experiences this. He's experienced
absolutely.
The same thing.
Yeah.
For, yeah. So,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
As
no.
a British man, like, it didn't matter where he's
also,
from.
Also, didn't know he was British until that interview.
Wow.
Until Sam Jackson said that, I looked it up and I was like, oh, that guy, I didn't know he was British.
I didn't know it till right now.
I knew it, but
the
Black Mirror episode, he's in the second Black Mirror, and he's British in that.
He's in the second, but he could have been doing that. I didn't know he was British until
his American accent.
Surprise,
is incredible.
Jamie, he's not American.
No idea.
Let's talk about the cold open.
Okay.
We have a list, and I'm going to go down it for anyone listening. Yep. So it's going to be weird segues, and that's okay.
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's all good. You'll get used to it.
Yeah.
The cold open, a lot of horror movies, we're talking horror again.
Yeah.
A lot of horror movies start with the cold open. I mean, one of the classic ones, probably Scream, the Drew Barrymore opening. And
honestly, the open that I think either deters you or sells you.
Yeah.
I remember watching that with my family, and they turned it off.
Really? Scream?
Well, because it was so like, this is the movie, either you deal with it or you don't.
Yeah.
Oh,
and I remember my mom going, this is disgusting, we're turning it off.
Oh, okay. They were expecting cute Drew Barrymore or something to survive.
Well, it's just the movie
Scream, didn't
it's kind of like, if you can take this scene, this movie is for you. It's kind of
selling tone.
The whole movie in one scene.
Yeah.
That's what Scream is.
Yeah.
Right?
Jaws is a great one, that's the one that I think of.
Yeah,
the cold open, because it's so intense. It's everything. Like you said, it's the whole movie.
It's the whole movie.
It's
in the scene.
Fan.
Yeah.
I think this one has a lot in common with Jaws. Like, why you do it? Get Out is very much, we'll talk about this, kind of a slow burn horror movie. And Jaws, it takes a little while before Jaws starts attacking people later on in the movie. So you almost have to you almost have to give the audience something in the beginning and also plant the bomb under the table. It's that Hitchcock bomb under the table.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, hey, it's okay, guys. We know you're in this for the horror movie. We're going to give you something later on. And that way, everything that happens from that point on, you're kind of looking at and waiting for the bomb to go off.
You're answering how that's going to come about. Well, you know, you're creating that question.
Right. It sets up a line. You're like, it's going to get here again.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you're going to have to wait for it. And you're going to have to see where, like, how long it takes to get back here.
Definitely.
So, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
But the main thing is there's a lot of people who want the horror genre beats satisfied, you know? They're hungry for that. So you give them up front and then you let them wait.
Yeah. Do you think that with, like, what you just said, do you think this is because this is a written and directed by a guy who's kind of like a pop mind?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about somebody who is, like, an expert comedian, a satirist, comedic performer. If you watch their show, like, they know pop culture and beats and scripts and tropes. These guys, like, I'm including Key in that too, but Peele, you know what I mean? Like, Peele loves movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, like, this movie feels effortless in its structure in a lot of ways. Like,
it's so impressive as a first effort.
But it makes sense to me. It comes from, like, a comedic master.
It's
does that make comedy sense? And horror are very similar, you know? Like,
absolutely. It's like the tension release kind of thing.
It's perfect. You know? Exactly. Yeah. That's a perfect comparison. Yeah.
And I think with Peele, too, while it's a first effort, you know, he had his own show, comes from sketch comedy background, I think, Second City kind of stuff.
They were Mad TV, and they were both on Mad TV, and then they did Second City and stuff before that, and then they eventually had their own show on Comedy Central. And everything,
The one thing about, you know, sketch comedy and things like that, unless you're pure improv, and even if you are pure improv, that's really all storytelling. I mean, there's people that work in Second City, they write their own stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sure Key and Peele, you know, he was writing all those episodes.
Oh, definitely,
And most of their skits were like short films. The thing about that show is they were just making short films.
Really,
they were great short films too with great premises. So,
So, you know, first effort, but he's probably had, logged years of experience.
That's true. Good point.
So
that's my point. Is like this, he's a sharp comedic master, and the jump to this and doing something he's probably really passionate about with a subject he's super passionate about, it clicks, man.
Do you know what his favorite movies are? I mean, I asked this question and probably nobody knows, but I mean,
we could look it up.
I remember, like, the Gremlins, the infamous Gremlins thing
which I saw because Joe Dante himself shared it.
Oh, okay.
That's great. I don't know, but I think they're, like I said, I think they're pop minds. He loves all genres. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I thought Keanu was one of the funniest.
Oh, I love Keanu.
Keanu was so great. And that was, like, you could tell how, like, much they love movies. Like, you know, in his apartment in that movie, there's, like, a New Jack City poster and a Heat poster. And then, you know, the whole thing was just rampant with tropes and callbacks. But it wasn't hacky.
No, not at all.
Nothing about it. Like, they wanted to make a real movie, but with, like, this insane love for pop cinema, pop, you know, everything, action movies and all that. So it doesn't surprise me that he's a great director.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know, like, because I always feel like people that can do comedy can do anything.
Yeah.
Bias, I know.
But, well, I mean, comedy is, like, the hardest thing to be good at, you know?
Yep. Tell the Academy Awards. Is that something?
No, you're right. You'll never get its due.
Anyway, back on track. Let's not insult the Oscars. But, sorry.
I think you're right, though. The cold opening, I think a large part of why you have to do that, and you see it all the time, is because if you're going to have a movie that kind of is that slow burn, and the mystery really is going to kind of simmer, the next scene starts the whole story, and it really is just a domino effect. We already start in motion.
You could just cut the front off, and
cut the front off.
Yeah.
But what would that do? What do you think it would do if you cut the front off? How do you think it would change things?
I think there's a positive and a negative to it.
Yeah.
Because up until they get to the house, it is kind of a very cute love story.
Yeah.
The girl is charming. The guy is charming.
Excellent performance from her. Like, I didn't. I actually didn't see it coming the first
time. No, I didn't either.
So, yeah. Like,
well, she's the one thing that remains in question the whole time. You know, you get the idea that something bad is going to happen by somebody who's there. But does she know that her family is fucked up? You know, and that's the question.
That's what. Yeah. I mean, I
is
think
she in on
the
it?
Intention in the script and from him, from Peele, is that you assume that she doesn't know what her parents are doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And yeah. Because I listened to the commentary and it's great and it's really insightful. He says every single scene, what his tool to disarm your suspicion was to have her never just like placating him, to be the opposite, to throwing his suspicions in his face, because his suspicions are all based on his prejudice, which was fascinating to me. I hadn't thought of it that way. Whenever he's making statements, it's his own version of prejudice that's coming out, and she's going like, whoa, you're being prejudiced right now. Like, you think this is about you. And that makes the audience go, oh, man, she's throwing it in his face.
Right,
you
know, right.
Like, so, yeah, it's smart, man.
Well, this is, I mean, it's a nuanced thing that he's really familiar with.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's like, this is kind of a write what you know scenario.
Oh, definitely.
Right? I mean,
Yeah.
We couldn't write this movie. You know,
no,
no,
oh, no,
it'd be impossible. No, please, never.
No,
yeah,
I no. could, I might. No, I could.
Well, as I said,
I could not write it.
You can write Meet the Parents,
a
right?
voice for people right. who are really like tall and what
Meet the Parents
to them
by Jamie Nash.
Everyday situations,
well,
people who are 6'5",
juggle five balls. I don't know, something
you,
like that.
You could be dating a very short woman, and,
short woman,
yeah.
It's about tall people.
How's the weather up there? Jokes. Lots of great things like that.
Stuff that really carries a movie.
Yeah, Jesus.
Right.
But if we lopped off the beginning and the slow burn, would people get bored, do you think? Do you think or do you think that charm would hold them through? Because really, the first sight of something really happening in this movie, that when it really says something weird's going on, I can think of two places. There's one where she stirs the teacup.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that doesn't happen for like 20 minutes.
That doesn't happen for 20 minutes. And then the next scene is probably when he goes outside and sees people run at him.
I think if you lopped off the front, to me, it would remind me more of something you would get in like an 80s like Cronenberg movie or something.
Yeah.
It's like the people start off very normal until things get...
Yeah.
It's like this... You know what I mean? Like...
Well, they play it completely straight.
Right, the first 15 minutes, it's almost like, what movie is this? It's nothing. It's just people talking.
But for me, if they... So to me, that's a premise delivery question. Yeah. Because, like, the promise of the premise is we're there to see a horror movie based on this scenario. So if you take off the opening horror bit, then there's no horror for another 25 minutes.
It would be almost like a sudden left turn.
Yeah, the movie. Exactly. It would be like...
You'd think you're watching, like, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner or something that this movie's been compared to. And then it would take this sudden, you know, left turn into a different genre.
It would be like the Dusk Till Dawn shift.
Oh, man, you read my mind. I was about to say that. Well, Jamie, from like a point of weird thing to think about with a weird callback is Peter Jackson's King Kong, which has no cold open, and King Kong doesn't even show up for like almost an hour.
That's a good point.
And that... It made me think of that because of movies that just don't get to the point. That was a colossal mistake for that movie, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no, like, it doesn't open on Skull Island and show you anything.
It's almost like, and it was based, because it was based off the original, that was that way too, which we have different tastes back then. You
know, exactly.
Back
in, that's what I'm saying. Our expectations
you're reading
for
my
what
mind
a movie
too.
Is.
I was going to say, like, he was kind of going to the old style of writing.
Absolutely.
Whereas, like, this seems like a modern choice to show that cold open.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine if Kong was a television show, and for the first five episodes, it was New King Kong. And then only
I mean,
the last
you know,
three
ballsy
years
art. Ago. Yes. Okay. Right. Right.
You just can't do it.
But that's why kids aren't into that movie. They weren't when it came out because it's like, where's King Kong?
Where's King Kong?
So in Get Out, I mean, with expectations and stuff, usually we talk, like screenwriters talk about things like catalysts or inciting incidents. Yeah. Usually they happen around, I mean, if you believe some of the books and all this stuff is just guidelines, you can break these rules all the time. And Jordan Peele does excellently in this kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
But the books will tell you by the 12-minute mark, you need to kick your story off. You need to have this inciting incident that starts kind of the conflict, or like you said, the premise.
The premise delivery
should be coming.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It should be initiated by the 12-minute mark. But in Get Out, I can't even tell you, and it works great. But I can't even tell you really what the inciting incident is, unless it comes at like the 30-minute mark.
Well, it is.
I was going to say. This movie is unique too, in that talking about scripts and the 12-minute mark and all that, there's already this, even before walking in the theater, there's an impending doom.
Yeah, definitely.
We already know that this movie is about racism and it's there. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's some rules that you can forego because just the general knowledge of the movie. Like, the whole time I was uncomfortable watching this movie. Yeah. Well, all four times I saw it, like, we know something's going to come.
I think that's part of, and that's part of that cold opening, not to, you know, go back to that, but it's dread. You know, it kind of gives that dread or that sense of unease. And that's really...
Society earned that dread.
Yeah.
Not the movie, didn't have to.
And you can really push that inciting incident back far or not have one if you can somehow deliver tension throughout the movie. Like, tension's everything, right?
Yeah.
So this movie has tension pretty much from the get-go, and it just keeps ticking the meter up a little bit, and it, you know, it gets more tense and more tense and more tense until finally it kind of explodes.
Well, so for me, I think about it like you said, the bomb under the table.
Mm-hmm.
I think of this movie like, I think Requiem for a Dream is a monster movie and drugs are the monster. And even when the drugs are off screen, you're fearing their effects. You know, they're there. You know, they completely affect every action that the character has taken. So for me, this is like a monster movie about racism.
Do you
racism.
Think Aronofsky was thinking that when writing
that? Absolutely. Like, that's why I think it's a horror movie. Okay. Yeah. And for me, like, this is a monster movie about racism, and racism is the monster that's off screen that, like, as an audience, we're fearing what its actions are going to have against our character, you know? And so with the suspense thing, this movie does a great job. It, like, creates, it's like one question after another is planted in your mind, and you are desperate to answer what the truth is behind this question. Like, did she unplug the phone? Like, and then we get an answer, but it's not what we thought it was, and it's kind of worse. She's kind of fucking crazy, you know? Like,
Then
what are the consequences that she's going to bring about to him later on, you know, as we learn she's crazy? It just does such a great job of creating never-ending questions that we, like, are desperate to answer, that we think the answers will lead to, like, us helping him out of the situation. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, once we figure out these answers, we know how to root for him to succeed. You know what I mean?
It's kind of like a foreshadowing ballet.
Oh, yeah.
It really is. Yeah. Like, I never even expected that going in.
That's a great...
What do you think the end... Because, honestly, this is one of those things. So, I'm into structure. You know, I like that stuff. I like the books. I like Robert McGee and Save the Cat and all that stuff.
Me too.
But what do you think the structure of this movie is? What do you think the first act of this movie
is? So I do think there's an inciting incident. I don't think it breaks the rules, because it's not really, the character isn't bringing about, you know, so I think the inciting incident is with the deer. And it's because, for me, like, he has a chance at that moment because it's coupled with the cop, then, you know,
which being is also
racist.
A ruse.
Yeah, yeah.
On
exactly.
of the script.
Yeah, it
where
is
she's
a ruse.
Doing, it's genius, because what she's doing, the audience thinks one thing, and she's actually doing another.
Yeah.
That deer moment, it's... So, to me, I'm not sure that it's technically, like, your usual inciting.
No,
incident,
agreed.
But it feels like an inciting.
It does.
And that's enough, right?
Yeah.
Because that's enough to keep the audience invested. It feels like an inciting incident. It feels important. It's the random event.
And it's a, like,
it's
an early whiff
field.
Of death,
it's
too.
So
like, it's an early whiff of death. Like, you know what I mean? It's kind of like he, even though it really is, like, creatively, it's a call back to the death of his mother.
Right.
But, like, from an audience standpoint, we're getting a glimpse of, like, what could happen to him. You know what I mean?
And it has nothing to do with the plot, really.
No,
it has nothing to do with the...
You could
anything.
Technically remove it and have the movie still work.
Exactly.
They could just show up. You wouldn't get that bit of, like, feel. It actually serves as a Save the Cat moment in some ways where she
kill
speaks
the deer,
up. Yeah,
the
she
cat.
Speaks up for him at when the policeman comes.
Yeah.
So it kind of gives you more reason that, you know, to feel good about her.
Yeah, it's a rooting influence for her, definitely.
But
definitely.
The genius is when you find out later what she was actually doing.
It's
covering the paper trail.
So genius.
Yeah,
that is so good.
So good, yeah. But that, for me, the act, it's another one of these, like, slippery slope, you could say, you could not say. For me, the end of act one is definitely, he does make the choice to walk into, like, the dragon's lair of her, like, hypnotizing him. He makes the choice. Like, it's such a slight choice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just takes, like, a step into that chair, and once he gets in the chair, he's fucked. But he sat down in the chair by his own, you know, choice.
And, you know, in a lot of horror movies, It's not a choice either. It's, you know, like in Poltergeist or something.
It's true.
The kid they gets kidnapped. Leave. They right. could have left before that.
Yeah.
It's not really their choice. It's just the thing that forces them to make choices later.
That's a good point.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know,
it's
yeah.
also a commentary yeah. on victimization.
Or, that's yeah. true.
People always say, why didn't they leave?
Yeah,
exactly. You know what I mean? You put people in these situations. They and don't, the, yeah.
You know, even making the title Get Out is kind of...
yeah,
right, right. Yeah, like, Get Out. Right. Like,
right from the title screen. You should have just read the title. I think I read somewhere that that music is actually saying something along. You know, the
yeah, I love that language. Music.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, he said
it's, it also plays into his whole, like, comedy deal, too. Like, I feel like it reminded me a lot of their show.
Yeah.
Because it was, like, this overly serious, mysterious, weird tone playing after all that had happened. Mm-hmm. Just showing, like, forest.
Right.
I was like, you know, because the deer dying also kind of adds this whole, like, auteur aspect of the movie. Like, you could remove that. You could remove a lot of stuff from a lot of movies that would, the plot would still be there. But it adds this, like, okay, this is actually by someone who has some other ideas that I have nowhere yeah. where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of just this moment of, it's the most artistic moment in the movie.
Yeah.
Is that,
yeah.
does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it builds up the rest of the weird stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
The dream, there's the stuff with the dreams.
The dreams.
Yeah.
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 No, I think you're right. The music always gets me whenever I watch the movie. And I really like it. And it's weird. While it creeps me out, it's kind of the tone of the movie. It's kind of welcoming. But it's also creepy. It's like
yeah. it's weird. Catchy, but it's,
yeah.
I feel strange, odd listening to it.
I feel odd.
And the composer, this was his first score.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's a jazz musician. He handpicked this guy who's a jazz musician who had a lot of weird music. And he was like, here's what I want you to do. It was like very deliberate choices. You know, of course it was.
Man, they. I hope that they can continue this momentum.
Yeah.
Well, because hitting it out of the park this hard right out of the gate is...
Well, Jordan Peele is definitely a flavor of the year, you know.
Definitely. I mean,
everybody wants to work with him.
He says on the commentary 3 or 4 times, he's like, I'm never gonna make something this good again. And he says it laughing too. He's like, I'm sorry. He's like, you're gonna have to give me a leash to make something bad, because like, I'm not gonna be able to make something like this.
He can make Jackie Brown next. Everybody will love it.
It's true.
In 10
yes.
years.
In 10 years. Yeah, come back to
hey,
it. Yeah.
I'd be fine. You know, Jordan Peele will never hear this, but I'd be fine if he made more comedy stuff too.
Yeah,
he doesn't
exactly.
need to make.
He doesn't have to make serious movies every time.
He can do anything. I mean.
But at the same time, maybe he's tired of doing comedy. He did it for so long.
Yeah, but you always want to go back.
Yeah.
I mean, he might want to go back to horror one day. You know.
Yeah.
He can do these things at his will. We shouldn't hold it to him.
That's true. Yeah.
Like, don't call somebody a horror master and then expect that's all that they can do.
Yeah.
Just because he did this.
Well, I think that's the reason this movie has such broad appeal, too, is it's kind of that Spielberg thing where he's getting big laughs in the middle of a otherwise serious tone, dread movie.
Yeah.
He's getting huge laughs.
Really?
And I think that's because he knows his stuff. No doubt.
Definitely.
No doubt.
Well, he's a master of one thing, and this showed he was a master of another.
Right.
Like, yeah, you know, and he kind of combined them both geniusly. So, yeah, you're talking about Rod, right? Like,
Rod.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah,
Rod is our like tension release. You know, after every time we get something crazy, it cuts back to Rod. And you're like, oh my god,
he's the guy you wish was in every movie.
Yeah.
And he just comments on what's going on. You know,
it's funny too, because the second time I watched it, I realized he wasn't in the movie as much as I thought he was.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
not in it that much.
But he stands out.
Yeah,
he stands out
so much.
He stands out so incredibly much. Yeah.
Back to the point about the act breaks. I totally agree with you. I think the hypnosis is the act break.
Yeah.
Because essentially, I always think of movies, your act breaks being once you're in the movie you came to see.
Yeah.
Then that's where your act break is.
That's where two starts.
Yeah, that's usually where two starts.
Okay.
And so, I like the before world, upside down world kind of, and then new world. That's a big helpful thing for me to think about when I'm writing myself or helping other writers, is like, okay, after this moment, their life will never be the same, no matter what. Right. So after he's put into the sunken place,
it
can never go back to the way it was, you know. So for me, and it's visual too.
A test I always have is if I showed someone my script for the first act, they could almost write my log line as soon as act 2 starts.
That's good. I like
so
that.
So they would know the goal, the obstacle, the stakes, all those things would kind of be defined in some way.
By the beginning of act 2?
But right at the beginning of act 2.
Okay.
So, you know, in Jurassic Park, it'd be, like dinosaurs are loose and people are trying to survive.
Right, right, yeah. Right.
That's what would happen. At
Act and two. Back to the Future, it's Will Marty get
Will
back
Marty
to
get
home, back to the future. You know? Yeah. We'll get back to the past. Yeah. Right. Will future.
Exactly.
Will Indiana Jones find the Ark before the Nazis?
Yeah.
And usually you can define it like as soon as that moment clicks, where you could hand your script over and somebody could write that. That's usually when you're in Act two. If you know, from a structure standpoint.
And you know, in a lot of movies, that question is already coming into focus, and then it is solidified in the end of Act One. Like, we know, we have an idea of what this movie is about for the whole Act One, and it is slowly becoming more and more into focus.
But, again, if we lopped off that opening scene, this would kind of be the first moment where we saw the creepy people outside running at him.
Yeah.
He gets hypnotized.
I almost don't know if it would be better or not. Like, there was part of me that thinks
it would be more what the fuck, and it's already like, oh, you're getting so much stuff.
And I'll say something. I didn't necessarily love that opening scene. It doesn't have a lot of, like, it doesn't have a big, like, aha moment to me. Like, some of these do. It didn't surprise me. It just felt, you know, grab a guy, put him in a trunk. It was important, but it's, of all the clever beats in this movie, that's not at its most clever.
No, you're almost selling me on it. It might, not being there might make the movie even weirder and scarier.
I think it might make it broader the way it is, because it gives people, it lets them relax.
It would make it broader. Okay, so he made an interesting point on the commentary, which is, as a white man, is something I would have never thought about. And he said, this is like one of a black man's worst fears.
Yeah. That's
is very you're good. Walking down the street and someone passes you in a car, and that car turns around and stops.
Makes sense.
And he said every single black man could relate that, you know what to do. You turn around and you walk away, and you definitely don't turn back around. And what did he do? He turns back around, and then he you know.
In that case, I'll shut up about the opening then. Because maybe that holds sense. That holds something I can't fully appreciate.
Right.
So, I of course had never thought of that.
Right.
And it didn't speak to me that way.
Right.
But once I heard it out of somebody with a different perspective, I was like, oh man, that's really good. You know?
And that's a key to good horror writing, right? Is you try to find things that personally, like, what are your fears?
Yeah.
He's probably had a situation where he was walking down the street and that very thing happened, and all those ideas were going through his mind. He turned it into a story element.
Yeah.
And if it appeals
to
him,
into something.
Yeah. And if it scares him, it's going to scare other people.
And it had so much darker meaning, but because it's so truthful.
Yeah. People are scared of going into the ocean. Make a shark movie.
Make a shark movie.
Exactly.
Right. He just, So, okay. Well, then
I'm sold.
So that sold. That plays to something that maybe we can't appreciate.
Exactly.
Fully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's so heavy.
So so we're talking about act breaks. Let's talk about what do you think the midpoint is?
Yeah. What do you?
I know.
You definitely. Know what the midpoint is?
You know?
I'm sold on it.
Well, go ahead.
I'm sold on it. And it's not because I cheated with the commentary. He didn't say it. It's the camera flashing.
Yeah.
And it's the false defeat that happens with the get out. Get out. Get out. It's that moment. Like really good midpoints for me are, not only is it as bad as we thought it is, it's worse.
Right.
And
it's also when the main character realizes
that's what
it's
I mean,
worse
than
he thought.
And a lot of times it's when audience fears align with character fears,
right.
You know, and like, I think at that point in the movie, Chris is on the same page as we are. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We are 100% thinking the same thing as the character, whereas before we weren't.
Yeah.
You know, and for me,
I agree. It's the stake raiser.
Exactly.
It's the thing that makes it. Usually, the midpoints make things more personal.
Yeah.
They make things, you're more trapped. They're more something.
Yeah, right? They're the emotional high or emotional low. Yeah. So it's like the peak emotional feeling of the movie. Yeah. Definitely. And the acknowledgement that everything we thought.
And his reaction from that. So what really
I like
happens,
that audience being on the same level thing.
Well, because
that's a good point.
Because for a lot of the time, like the character is catching up to what we know.
Right.
You know, and once it happens, then it's like deeper.
And the key thing really it's doing again, it's like ratcheting up the tension again.
Yeah. You know? It's a major stakes raiser, as you said.
And the character feels it too. He's ready to get out at that point. I mean, that's the point where he's like, we got to get out of here.
Well, so like one thing that I didn't realize until we were making, you know, thinking about what we're going to talk about. The question we asked, the central story question, which for me is a huge important thing to think about as a writer, what is the audience rooting for an answer to by the end of this movie? And you know, Act One sets that, solidifies
so
that into place.
Like, will they destroy the Death Star?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
For this movie, it's the same, and then its meaning changes. So from the beginning of the movie, it's, will Chris make it out of this weekend with his girlfriend's parents unscathed, right? Will he make it out of this weekend that we can all relate to, meeting like a girlfriend's parents for the first time? It's a really important primal moment. And it that question doesn't change, you know, but its meaning and the stakes behind it change, you know? So it's like we are always focused on the same
thing. It goes from being a metaphor to being like straightforward. Yeah, will I make it through this weekend?
Yeah, exactly.
Because will I live through this weekend?
Well, I live through this weekend.
It's almost like, will our relationship survive to will I survive?
Right. Yeah. Because the stakes for him are the... We didn't talk about stakes yet, but like the stakes for him the whole time are the abandonment of the relationship with his girlfriend, you know, but the stakes for us the whole time are his survival.
Of just him being alive. Yeah.
No, because we saw the opening scene, we know that it's really going to be, will he survive?
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, for him, for sure.
Yeah. And then they align with us eventually. Like he's thinking is the same thing we're thinking. Like.
And it's good to know too, like around the midpoint too, like after he has as much knowledge as us, mm-hmm. he stays.
Yeah.
And it's all out of his care and the stakes of his relationship.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of people would be like, I'm leaving. I'll just walk. Yeah. I don't even need a car. Like, right. I'm out of this.
Yeah.
If this hurts us, I'm going. But he doesn't.
And
his loyalty is like a big character aspect to this, right? Like, he's willing to keep going after that moment because of her. Because he loves her. That says a lot about him.
You know, it's also an interesting point. A lot of horror movies do this, but a lot of other movies don't do this. And I think there's a reason why. And I think it involves Get Out. Horror movies often have to keep people in the house as long as possible.
Yes.
So they tend to try to hide the monster. Like, is the house haunted? Maybe not. But they wait to the midpoint to say, oh, shit. The house
it's
is
really
haunted.
Our friend just turned up dead.
Yeah. Even a lot of times they're trying to hide the monster. They're trying to hide the monster to the second half of the movie. So a movie like Alien, for example,
that's why
the chest burster really doesn't happen until more closer to the midpoint.
Yeah.
And I think this movie functions the same way. They're trying to hide the monster. We know it's there. It's creeping up on us. It's all around us. But then it takes until the flash goes off, until we kind of start getting more of the monster. And almost right after that, I think the bingo scene happens.
Yeah, the like bingo scene does. It's like two or three scenes later.
So it's kind of like Jordan Peele, when he's writing it, is like, okay, now I can open up. Now I can start showing it.
The floodgates can open. Yeah. We can show the darkness of these scenarios. Yeah, the true darkness of this. Yeah.
Unleash the beast.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, like everything that he sets up in the script makes it so that Chris can't just abandon anything. They live out in the woods in a place he's never been.
Seclusion.
She has the cars, the car keys.
Yeah.
He can't run at that point. After like the flash happens, it's like to get out, he actually has to. Yeah. He would have to break his own moral code, like by stealing a car, or you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Like he would actually have to do something that he wouldn't normally do to leave, and he doesn't. Yeah,
and even at that point, he still has to act like a normal guy getting out. He can't just run away.
If you remember,
not like primal, like I'm out of here, and then there's a hole in the wall with the shape like Roger Rabbit. You know.
Well, after the debate with Rose, he eases off a little bit. That debate is what leads him to send the picture to Rod. Like, and he like has a smile on his face when he sends it. Like, this guy, what happened with this guy? Like, he almost like steps back into that like naivete.
I'm being silly, you know. This like is it just, can't it's all possibly, just a bunch of weird stuff, man.
You know. Yeah. And then what happens? Rod's like, that's Dre. He is that guy you knew. And then he's like, oh, and he literally is like, oh shit, I knew that. Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's just so good. Yeah.
I think that increases the tension, and it really at that point it just kind of snowballs.
Oh yeah, definitely. He keeps going.
Yeah, he gets to that point where he is trying to escape. The big reveal is that kind of crisis moment, that all is lost moment where she's also in on it. And I think that's the ultimate, you know, thing that the bottom drops. That's
all hope is lost right there.
The gasp.
Yeah,
it is.
Every time I saw the audience gasped at that moment.
It feels so obvious, but it definitely worked. Watching a second time, it's like, how did I not figure that one out?
Right.
Even when you know it, it's almost like you're on the side of the movie. You're like, good job.
Yeah, well, job. It's yeah. Rose. They did. Yeah, yeah. Rose sells it. She does. Every single scenario, if we truly suspected her in any of those scenes, in that debate scene where he like starts crying, he mm-hmm. reveals what happened to his mom, and he's like, I don't want to leave you, you know what I mean, like, but I have to, well, because this is crazy,
the performance is great.
I was gonna say, do you give the credit to the script or the performance on this?
I think there's a little bit of both, because yeah. I think we as the audience have to, because this is what we do, right? We slip into him. Yeah. We become, you know, kind of like the people in the movie do. We kind of go behind his eyes.
Right. Yeah.
But we have to fall in love with her. Yeah. And I'm sitting there watching, and, you know, I'm letting my mind drift, and I'm, you know, I'm like, yeah, this is a great girlfriend. She's yes. awesome. And yeah. you have to feel that way. And every time she has a sense of humor, she's smart, she's sensitive, all these yeah. things. And I think a lot of that is writing. You have to have a good performance on top of it. But certainly, you could see that falling apart too. Also, if the writing wasn't good.
I think they kind of had this. This helps with. This goes into the script too. Like both of them kind of seem like these city dwelling kind of artistic mm-hmm. not hipster types. Yeah. So she seems like she's kind of a liberal bent absolutely. To her, and they're going to the country to her parents, which are probably a little more conservative. Right. So it seems the whole setup seems like, of course, she wouldn't agree with her upper crust country dwelling country club yeah. parents. So she, the whole time, it sells you on her yeah, being,
she's rolling her eyes at the whole thing,
right? Exactly.
Well. And it's, that really helps
her reactions to everything yeah. that she always acknowledges his feelings about the situation. She never downplays anything that he's saying. It's
she's
almost
the scariest
like,
character.
Yeah,
without
it's
a
almost
doubt.
Like yeah. it's almost like she, like, even though she is lying to him, it's almost like she's never lying to him. Do that's you know right. what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's why it works so well.
It's really scary. Yeah. You think the lengths that she goes to do this to people?
Yeah.
How sick it is? Yeah. It's yeah. beyond sick. Even almost, it's more sick in the first half when she's fooling yeah. them than it is when they actually get like the brain transplant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, she's actually falling in love, like making these people fall in love with her. It, yeah. Wow.
And
it's nuts.
And so for me, one of my only problems I ever had with the movie was once I heard it on the commentary. And like, granted, like hearing a director say it should not be the saving grace of something you have a problem with, but like mm-hmm. once I saw it in the, so when the closet is left open, and they did visually set up the closet, he looks at that closet multiple times in multiple scenes, like what's
Chekhov's
in the closet?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Then the closet is open for him, and I was like, why would she let him in on it? But he said she. In the commentary, she does this with every single one of her previous victims. She is a cat who loves fucking with the mouse, and she wants him to know because she wants to see him squirm. And that's awesome, man. Like, when you think about that last scene,
absolutely.
That she let him into that closet just so she could see him panic and freak out the way he does, that she was like excited
well,
about that.
Doesn't that
like,
go into what I just said? She yeah. is sadistic.
Yeah, dude. It's well, so...
She's gotta love this.
One of the problems, like one of those things I came out of the movie and I was trying to go back over it when I first saw it, that I had a problem with was, why would you do what she does when you could just do what they did to the guy in the first scene, which yeah. is drive up, grab him, put him in a trunk yeah. and drive off?
Yeah.
Why would you ever have to go through this huge ruse and uproot your family and have yeah. everybody pretend to be things they're not? It didn't make sense to me. The only way it makes sense is that she's just flat out sociopathic and
yeah.
likes
oh,
yeah. likes doing it. It's like her trophy hunting.
Yeah, I don't even it think, is her yeah. trophy hunting.
I don't
and
even
she...
think her family enjoys it as much as she does.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's
her
that's
brother chose to be the kidnapper with the mask.
Yeah.
And she chose to do this.
That's right. That's right.
Right, right.
That's right.
The fundamental difference between the two of them.
So that kind of explains it for me, you know.
Yeah.
It's just her personality. And obviously for somebody to be the way she was in the beginning and the way she is in the end, she must just have a few screws loose.
Yeah.
I think the Fruit Loops milk scene kind of says it
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
I mean, that scene's there to show that she is not, she's like
not
American
right.
Psycho
yeah.
at that point. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She's like a perfectionist. So
and I didn't notice the first yeah. couple times that I saw it, but I noticed the last time that she's already putting her hair up into her true like form in the middle of like he's on the floor and she's already like putting her hair
yeah
in
she's
the ponytail,
becoming her real
like,
face that's right. yeah her real face
at that point though because we're kind of in this range here's a question I have. Do you see a, you know, because it's a writer question we get all the time, do you see a character arc in this story, like, and what do you think it is if there is a character arc?
It's tough for me because it's there, it's clear, it's obvious, but its ending doesn't isn't as clear as the rest of the movie is at dealing with his inner demons. You know, his inner demon is that he abandoned his mother when he could have helped her.
Right. He's haunted by his inaction.
By his inaction.
Only a slight inaction. Yeah. Almost like a feared act.
Yeah. Exactly. And this goes for me. I don't know if this is true, but it connects with his fear of abandoning Rose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that calls back to his like character issue. But I don't know that picking up the woman in the road and putting her in the car
is big enough. And
because
it feels like something he might have done in the beginning of the movie.
Right.
Not something he learned over the course of the movie.
And while it is like a major visual payoff of what we know he didn't do, it's a reversal.
It's almost more setup payoff.
Yeah.
Than a learned lesson.
I don't know that. Yeah. I don't know that when he's sitting at home after this movie is over, which is a whole other discussion, if he's like over the demons of his mom. Right. You know what I mean?
Probably has a whole nother set of
exactly. He's even more fucked up.
Yeah. On top of just what you guys are saying with, is it enough to pick that woman up, put her in the car?
I mean, it's enough for the audience, I think.
There really, because if I had a criticism of the movie, it would be that moment. Only because it's not just about like his emotions. It's the logistical thing of he knows that it's a brain surgery thing.
Yeah.
So though he knows it's not her brain.
They make a big point that she's still in there.
She's still in there.
So, yep. And that's,
you mean deep down.
Deep down.
He knows that.
Yeah.
Because they even say
some things. Because he saw it with Dre.
They even say some things later on, like if he accepts it, it helps the process and things like that.
Yeah.
And when she, you know, he saw her crying on the inside, like her, that part. He saw her tears. So he knows deep down
somebody's stuck in there.
I don't have a problem with him bringing her in the car. What I'm saying is, as a writing standpoint, it's a major heroic moment. I love the idea that he thinks maybe in that split moment, maybe I can save her. You know what I mean?
I just don't know that it's a character arc.
My point is, I don't know that it is a the transformational moment that it wants to be.
Right.
And I feel weird saying that to a script that may win the Oscar for best screenplay.
I don't think it hurts it.
No, it doesn't hurt it.
I think it feels like a character arc, but it's not.
Yeah,
like,
okay, so we're on the same page about
and
this.
Even the deer and all that stuff, that feels like character moments. And when I heard him talk, like instantly my bells were ringing. Oh, classic character arc kind of stuff. It almost felt like, no, and I don't mean this negative at all, but by the numbers character arc stuff. Like when I heard it, I'm saying it's going in part of my brain.
But do you feel like Chris is supposed to be this incredibly rich character? I don't know if he is. You know what I mean? Like
he's rich, kind of, depth-wise.
Yeah, like he's kind of, I don't want to say that the audience surrogate thing again or anything, but
he's an everyman.
He's a very everyman photographer.
He's kind of quiet.
He's a quiet guy. He's an observer.
Well, the quietness though goes to his having to deal with the situation.
Well,
he is. But, okay. I don't think he's necessarily a quiet man.
He's not the kind of guy you'd hang out with and say that guy's a character.
Yeah, that's true.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, like he's a very subdued, like kind of just looking at he's an observer as a character.
But, and here's why I'll step into territory again. Three white guys discussing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So please forgive that.
Forgive
part
us.
Of it. But
we apologize. Hey, it's a great script, but we apologize.
175 million. A lot of white guys did go see the movie.
I saw four times. Paid every time.
Yeah, exactly. I own the Blu-ray. So I paid for it.
So Jordan appeals to us too. For
definitely,
sure. We're all Jordan fans.
Appeals.
Jordan appeals.
Is that what you meant?
I did not.
Oh, jeez. I'm sorry.
That's something more Jimmy would.
Oh yeah, that's my territory. Jordan appeals.
Okay. So here's usually the character arc is related to the overall theme
and
of the movie.
For me, they're completely disconnected, and that's why I have a problem.
I've been bending my mind to try to connect, so I'll do a really bad connection.
Okay.
And this is where it gets to dangerous white guy territory.
Definitely.
I'll just stand back from the mic here. Just kidding.
Let's say the movie is, you know, Jordan Peele and stuff has said it's about, you know, a post-racial society. We think racism is over. And to our face, you know, to him, it feels like these rich people are acting like they're not racist, and they're pretending like their racism doesn't exist.
The Obama line kind of summed
that all up.
And that exactly.
So in that sense, the theme seems to be somewhere in there. You know, it's like it still exists. Whether we just because we say it's not or put a pretty face on, there's still other things that can hurt us. And I almost wonder if, and this is me really bending the facts, but to me, trying to be the writer and connect these things, it's almost like if the main character is almost saying, hey, inaction won't solve this problem. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like just sitting back and saying racism is over isn't good enough. Yes, we have to stand up and act.
Like I should have with my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where I'm. And again, this is all.
I think that's good. The fact, but that's how I'm trying to point.
Try. I wouldn't have that thought. I actually wouldn't have thought of that.
That
so
doesn't speak
pretty...
to his character's wound, though, which is about inaction. Yes, it does, because he was inactive with his mother.
No, it totally
that's a
good does.
Point. Yeah. So for me, let's bring the, because we didn't talk about the sin, and I think the sin and the theme go hand in hand. So you want to explain the sin?
Oh, yeah, sure. So and I again, Blake Snyder, Save the Cat stuff, which I'm a fan of. He has a thing called a monster in the house movie. And a monster in the house movie has, I think, three elements. It has a monster. It has a house right. that they're trapped in. And the house can be, it can be a spaceship. It can be the world. It can be anything. You know, Cable Guy is actually a monster in the house movie. Or What About Bob is a monster in the house movie. It just means you're trapped with something.
With something,
or
right.
some monster.
Right.
But the one key thing that he brought to it that I find interesting, and you see it in other worlds, is usually that monster is brought about by some sin.
Right.
So there's some societal wrong that brings the monster. And you can imagine most horror movies are kind of morality plays where you did something wrong, so you brought the monster.
Yeah. So for me, what was complicated and hard to answer, also as a white man talking about this, is what
we gotta keep saying
what,
that
no
yeah,
but we have,
really
to.
Have to yeah
well because the question then becomes what did Chris do wrong, right? Because it's because what the sin is about what the main character is
trust
not, not always
was it trust
not, for me though I have an answer that
okay,
I think
good.
Works
well, go for it.
So for me, this movie is about marginalization, is about Black people being looked at just as soulless people with no individual identities. Mm-hmm. And that is what happens to him over and over again when he's in the house, you know, with the Tiger Woods, and the people are not looking at him as Chris. People are looking at him as just a Black man.
A vessel.
Right. Soulless. Right. Who he is does not matter. He allows himself to be treated that way. Scene after scene after scene. He allows himself to be marginalized without speaking up and being like, hey man, right. like I'm not just because I'm a Black guy doesn't mean like I know who Tiger Woods is. Like right. what I'm saying is like if there was a sin created by this character, it would be that. And to me, that speaks
that seems,
to the
it
theme.
Yeah, it goes right to the title.
And
he should have left, but he took it.
And like for me, like you turned me on, Jamie. There's a book called The Moral Premise for
right.
any writers out there.
Yeah.
It's fucking fantastic. Stanley Williams. I've never looked at a movie the same again after reading this book.
Really?
The Moral Premise.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm a big fan of it. And not every writer reads that book. It's not
no.
a real popular one.
It's a brilliant assessment of how to use theme.
And it's simple.
And it's so it's the Save the Cat for theme.
You could
right?
probably go on the blog and see, and
yeah.
get enough information.
Exactly. So, okay.
Well,
so yeah. what the moral premise teaches, which I adhere to, I love it, is that essentially every thematic statement can be broken down to a vice leads to the character's success or failure, and a virtue leads to the character's success. So for me, this movie would be self-marginalization leads to oppression, right? Permanent mm-hmm. imprisonment and dignity leads to freedom. And to me, that like that's all
wow.
that's the whole movie. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
that's amazing.
I think that's great. And I think that feeds into my inaction thing about the deer.
And it's perfect. Yeah, when you told me that, when you said that, I get it. Yeah,
I'd probably
I
even go more Malcolm X with it, like you have to fight.
Yeah, no, it, fight. You know, no, I think you're right.
There's
I think
probably even something more extreme.
Instead of dignity, it's
yeah.
way beyond dignity.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what the right
vice is.
You put into words what I felt from the movie. Does that mm-hmm. make sense? What you just said with the whole yeah. the inaction thing? Because mm-hmm. the whole thing, it does feel like Chris is a stagnant character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He just sits.
He allows this to happen.
He allows it to happen.
He allows himself to be treated this way. And we as a society,
in the movie,
allow people to be treated this way.
Everything in the movie is daring Chris to do something.
Yeah.
Please try.
Please.
Speak up. Do anything.
And it came out around the time of the Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movements and all these things that are...
Which he did not intend. No. He said he did not know that was going to happen.
But it's sort of amazing how things are in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, the zeitgeist.
And those things rise, you know, to the forefront. And, you know, it's right... That's why it's so timely. It hit the zeitgeist.
And it came from a voice I don't think anyone was expecting.
No.
Here's this sketch comedy guy.
But perfect to tell it.
Right, no, right. Perfect. It's a perfect voice, but it was like no one was expecting the Key and Peele guy to come out with this left hook that was like, what? You know, that.
Yeah.
There's half your box office right there.
Yeah.
Just the surprise of him.
Yeah. It's a great story behind the story.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
definitely.
It's a Rocky right there.
Yeah, that's a good, but once you, I'm sold. I'm sold on the inaction being
absolutely. Being I think the inaction things are great.
Yeah,
but I would love to hear what he has to say about
and
it.
And he doesn't say it on the commentary. He doesn't talk about that. The arcing. He talks about the character.
Watch,
he
says something completely.
Yeah,
out
I know
there.
We're going to look like a bunch of jackasses.
Well, it's one of those things. All this stuff is kind of in the eye of the beholder.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's good to talk about it, you know, after the fact, because it helps us.
Yeah.
You know,
how to apply it. It's talking about how to apply it.
Heavily recommend you guys and anyone listening to watch the Vanity Fair thing with him going through the fan theories.
Oh, it's great. I've seen it.
Absolutely great. The fans come up with things and he's just like, no, but that's actually. I love it though. He a few times admitted that the fans idea of the movie was smarter than what he thought it was. And he says, sure. It's yes.
Yeah.
Great video. It was a great video.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
I think that should bring. I mean, like we're. I think we
I think
bring
we've
us,
covered it all.
We,
yeah.
The only thing we should really talk about, I think, is the original ending versus the.
Oh
the
yeah,
movie
let's
ending,
talk about.
Which
it,
is something I was kind of fascinated by seeing it the first time.
What do you think?
The obviousness of what you thought was going to happen versus what did.
Yeah, I, when I watched the original ending, it's funny. I probably would have written that original ending if I was in Jordan Peele's shoes. Yeah. I understand why he wrote it. It's probably more fitting overall in some ways with the. With the fact
once
that,
again, white guys talking about
it. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think it's more fitting in the fact that, hey, this post-racial society will get you every which way. Even when you think you're about to have justice,
yeah,
it'll get you again. So that's why I can understand why he wrote it that way. But as a crowd pleaser, there's no, I don't think I heard a better pop in the audience than when Rod shows up and gets out of that car. And I actually think, because there's a brief moment where we think the ending's going to go the way Jordan Peele had it, that's in our mind.
Yeah.
So we're like,
we know
it's a reversal of expectation.
He doesn't need to show up because it's already there.
It's already there.
Yeah. We already know it. And then we can have this hopeful moment.
Yeah.
We have.
There's finally ends on hope.
Yeah.
I think it makes it a better movie, honestly, if he kept it. But I think it makes it a more emotionally satisfying movie that he did. Did you hear him talk about it, though?
Where he said, like, he's like, I did that, and then I thought, this doesn't normally happen, and I want to give people something that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, no, I think it's a more emotionally satisfying movie that he ended up using.
Give people a movie that it was about a bunch of weird stuff that never happens, you know, as far as the Coagula stuff. So he's like,
back to the moral premise, I mean, that's that guy's key, right? He always says that if you end on a down ending, your movie won't make money if it ends on this tragic ending. And I think one of his points, I'm going to credit it to him. He says it's better to write a movie that the way you wish the world would be. That's why people go to movies. They go to movies.
It's wish fulfillment. Yeah.
They go to see the world that they wish they would exist.
Easy reference. I saw The Mist 4 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every time people walked out pissed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, I love The Mist.
Yeah,
but,
me too.
Right. But it was not a crowd pleaser whatsoever. No. And people were like actively angry walking out of that theater, like yelling at the screen.
Yeah. I mean, imagine if Rod had shown up and killed a tentacle monster.
Right. That'd be amazing. Wouldn't you cheer? Right. Yeah. Rod just starts showing up in movies.
Just start putting him in to save the day in every movie.
Yes, motherfucking A. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
The Rod Ex Machina.
But I think you're right, though, if the original ending would have cut the box office in half.
Yep.
Yeah. And
it almost become more of a art house movie, too.
I've heard Jason Blum.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Jason Blum has talked about the ending, and he actually says he gives his filmmakers total freedom. That's part of the deal. You make the movie for this money, you get total freedom. I'll give you notes. You don't have to listen. And they tested it. And he basically gave the note. He said, look, if you change the ending, this movie will probably make a lot more money. It's your call. And Jordan's like, no, no, I really like the original ending. This is from Jason Blum's perspective. But then he thought about it and he decided he could change it and still get his message across. Wow. That's a story I've heard. If you're a Jason Blum interview in recent days, that's a thing he usually gives.
It goes, I think with what we just said, it's there.
Yeah.
Because when that car shows up, everyone goes, oh.
It's really going to end this way.
You've already written that ending. We don't need to see it.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's
we all know. Yeah. So yeah. Like, it's honestly, the one that ended up in theaters is both endings.
Yeah. Right. That's true.
It happens in our minds. And then the happy part happens. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I don't know. In a way, I think it's a better movie for that.
Yeah.
I agree.
It was the right choice. You know, I think if it ended on the down note, I don't know. It's not a movie that I would have probably seen four times.
Yeah. Good point.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, good point.
And I think the more people see the rest of the movie and enjoy it, knowing that that hopeful moment is coming, the better, because the whole movie has the right message to tell. So
yeah.
Make something that people want to watch a lot. Does that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, rewatch. Yeah.
Keep it, because, yeah, like I said, it'd be like an art house movie almost with that ending. And then people would be like, yeah, we get it. Heavy handed.
Yeah.
Enough. It's not fun. I don't want that ending. Right. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, all right. Three white guys talking about Get Out. It's a great script.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean,
great execution, too, obviously. Yeah. The performances, though. I think her performance... Did she get nominated?
No.
I think just him.
Just him?
Yeah. I think.
That seems weird to me, because her performance is so good.
What else have we seen her in? Anything?
I don't know.
I don't watch Girls. She's in Girls.
Is she?
She's a main character in Girls.
Huh. I watched the first couple seasons, but I guess I don't remember it well enough, or at least who's who.
Yeah. She's in Girls.
And he's all. And he's.
This was her first film.
Okay.
That's a big one to start on.
And he was in Black Mirror, and I'm not sure what else. He's fantastic, though. That's one of my favorite Black Mirror episodes.
And you probably couldn't have cast the parents any better.
Oh, I know.
Bradley Whitford, right?
Yeah. People we trust.
Well, he's kind of always.
Yeah, he's kind of a schemer.
He's kind of typecast at that. Yeah. Yeah. When is he's not? When is
we
he
trust
not
Catherine Keener, though.
Yeah, Catherine Keener is a warm presence.
He's kind of a guy we trust, but then he's still doing Cabin in the Woods stuff in the background.
Or something. He's so amazing in that
scheming
movie.
Yes. In the White House or something.
He's fantastic in everything he does. West Wing.
Billy Madison. I mean, yeah, he's always been kind of a schemer, you know. But you guys have anything left to say about?
No. Go, if you haven't seen it, why are you listening to this?
I don't think anyone that hasn't seen it be listening. So
I think the title is really Get Out and Go See It.
Yes, perfect.
Yeah.
That should be the tagline.
Underneath, and go see it.
Go see it.
Jeez.
Yeah.
No. All right. Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in.
This first episode
of
a script podcast where we only talk about blockbusters, which we're just going to pretend is the only one that exists. Because as far as I know, it is. And I'm not going to do any research otherwise. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for coming, guys.
Right, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You've just listened to Writers Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.